first thing my teacher ever wrote on his slate, my teacher was silent. My teacher's up there. He was a very beautiful guy. He's a very pure Brahmin. He's a very sattvic man, very pure, good man. The guru is a realized being. He's beyond it all. See? But the teacher is still busy being a good man. He's really good, too. I mean, he is the essence of good man. He is as pure as they come. He's so pure it makes you weep, because you just don't believe such purity is. Anyway, that's one of the things that blew my mind about the villages in India. There really is the possibility that human beings can be so pure. Because I had rationalized away, you just need all this sort of deception to make it all work. I've told this story before, but I won't read it. I'll just tell it this time. See, when I was a psychologist, I remember this is where we got to in the non-lying trip. I was teaching an introductory course in psychology. And I had 500 students in the class. It was the first course I ever taught. I was 24 or 5. And it really panicked me tremendously. And I was teaching it because I don't think anybody else wanted to teach it. It was Psych 1 is kind of a bad scene. And one of the big professors, I was an acting instructor, than which there is nothing lower. And the one of the full professors sent his assistant, his research assistant, around to me, and he said, we would like a number of subjects for an experiment for your class, but it's a stress experiment we're doing, and in order to do this, you must tell the students that they must enroll for this experiment and that what they do in this work will be put on their permanent records. So I said, well, will it be put in their permanent records? He says, of course not. He said, but we'll tell them later. After all, it's for experiment, it's for science. And I said to him, well, look, you may be a research scientist, but I happen to be the instructor in this class, and there is a certain relationship between students and an instructor which allows the students to trust the instructor. And if I get up and start to lie to the students, who are they ever going to believe? I mean, don't you think that relationship is in some way privileged? I mean, shouldn't I be straight with them? Come on now, don't be naive. I said, well, that's the way I'm going to do it. I won't do it. Well, we'll see about that. So the next thing, the full professor came up. Don't worry, he said, I'll take all the responsibility for it. I said, I don't care whether you'll take all the responsibility. It's my course. I'm the instructor, even though I'm an acting instructor, and I make $3,400 a year. That's the way it is. Well, we'll see about this. So the next thing, we were at the chairman of the departments. Chairman of the department said, now, Richard, don't be naive. I mean, this is done every day. They'll know afterwards. This is the only way we can create the stress conditions that are necessary to arouse their anxiety to study their anxiety. Don't you understand? I said, I understand, you're just not going to do it in my course. So already it was now becoming an issue of not only my job, but since it's all done by personal contact, my whole future was like now riding on this whole issue. So finally, the chairman of the department said, well, would it be all right if I did it? In other words, the chairman of the department is asking me, is it all right if I come into your course and perjure myself? I said, sure, man, you can do anything you want. That's your trip. As long as all I say to the students is, may I introduce you to the chairman of the department? You can do anything you want. Now, that was a cop-out. That was where I was at in those days. This was 1954. That's the karma I'm still paying off on. That was the world I was living in, the world of sophistication. Before I went to India, I was traveling in the Southwest in a school bus, and we went to an Indian reservation at Hota Villa. Hopi Indians. And I met with the elders, who were all about 100 years old. And they were extraordinarily beautiful men. And one of them was telling me the story of how they were having trouble with the Indian Bureau, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He said, one of our boys had an accident with one of the cars owned by the Bureau. And the lines on the road showed that the Bureau's car was over the line. But the next day, the police found a liquor bottle in the gutter nearby, and they said it belonged to the boy who was from our reservation. And he said, this man is in his 60s. He's the junior man. He's the spokesman. And he said, the boy said the liquor bottle was not his. The boy speaks truth. Now, I don't know whether I can put into the inflection into my voice to communicate to you that when he said that, there was no doubt in my mind all the way back through his head and the boy's head, that they were living at that moment in a world in which one speaks truth. And suddenly, before my head, having grown up in a family where my father and two brothers are lawyers, write it all down, get it signed, notarized, watch it, don't trust anybody. Suddenly somebody says, and he speaks truth, and that's that. Wow. Just blew my mind. Right here in America. So I feel, well, they're old Indians, you know, and they're dying out. And then I was in the mountains in the Himalayas, and there were the people living with these same values. I mean, I was just too paranoid for the scene. I couldn't handle, I couldn't believe that people could be like this. I mean, they could really be where they're at. They say what they mean. They're really right here. They're right here. You know, we would be driving in a big fancy Land Rover we had in the first part of the trip, and you'd stop to go to the toilet. And suddenly, 100 people would be standing around the Land Rover. It's called instant crowd in India. There's just so many people, and they're not doing anything particular, so they hang out. They're all standing about 4 inches from your nose with huge big eyes, and they're looking right at you. Now you go through, the first thing you go through is your paranoid take. What do they want? Isn't there any privacy? Voyeurists, eh? Why don't they leave me alone? They want money, they want food, what do they want? It's them. Them. They're looking at us just like you look at a flower, like, wow, dig that. They don't want anything. They're just here. They're really here, though. Boy. Ooh, right here. Right here. Right here. And that's scary when you're not here, because it's a pretty strong wind that comes. That's powerful vibrational stuff when you meet here and now people. Really powerful. And they kept peeling away my paranoia like layers of an onion. I mean, a guy would walk from the village like 5-6 miles carrying a beautiful, some fresh mangoes. And he'd give them to me. And I would go through, what can I give him in return? Why did he do that? I mean, he put me up tight because now I got to do something for him. Because I'm in the world of giving and receiving. But he doesn't live in the world of giving and receiving. There are the mangoes, and there's Ram Dass at the temple, and wow, I mean, like, it just all, and I'm, like, walking to the temple carrying the mangoes to give to Ram Dass. He's giving the mangoes to us like we got two bodies and one consciousness. It's like my mouth's going to eat them because I'm doing the spiritual work, and that's my trip, and he's, like, helping my trip because that's his trip. And there's nothing in it for him. He doesn't want me to do anything for him about it. See what non-giving and receiving means. Tonight, before we began. Food was brought to me, bread was brought to me, sweets were brought to me. My guru sits in India, and loving women cook all night to bring him food. And he must eat 15 meals a day, I swear. He just sits there all day long, and these women bring him this exotic stuff they've cooked for him. And it's made with so much love, and it's so pure, and he's doing their karmic thing by eating the food. See, he's doing the thing with them, like a love thing. And so all day long, he's just talking, and he's, oh. Oh. And mouthfuls of, you know, exquisite things are coming into his mouth, and he just keeps eating. I couldn't believe it. Passes it all through like Chinese food. But it's not giving and it's not receiving, because there is nobody giving and there's nobody receiving. That's the point. There is nobody speaking here and there is nobody listening. There is Om Mani Padme Hung, and here we all are in Om Mani Padme Hung, and giving and receiving is going on. The Buddha says it's only when you realize there's no doer that you get off the wheel of life and death. First thing that the teacher wrote on the slate, the pure Brahman I got waylaid way back there, he wrote on the slate was, desire is a trap, desirelessness is moksha, meaning liberation. Desire is the creator, desire is the destroyer, desire is the universe. And the fact of the matter is, if you understand that, you're all finished with the whole business. Take the example of vibrations, or in psychology we would call it how motivation affects perception. Same thing. Okay. Most of you are seeing me and each other. There are some beings in this room that see auras when they look at other people. And they also see astral beings who are also present in this room. There are beings in this room who at this moment see astral beings. You don't see them, most of you, because your radio receiver is not tuned in that particular vibrational frequency. Your desires create your universe. There's an example of how your desire to know the world through your senses keeps you limited to a certain vibrational rate and keeps you living at a certain vibrational level. Don't get upset, those are the horses back in the stable. Desire creates the universe. Standing on the corner watching all the girls go by. Pretty weird being in this little village in the Himalayas and watching the Indian boys going to school in one direction and the Indian girls going to school in another direction. And here are all these beautiful chicks in saris, and they're so beautiful. I mean, Indian women are, oh, essence beauty. And the guys are walking down the street talking to each other just like there was nobody coming the other way. Figure, well, they're certainly highly trained. I mean, they're 17 years old. Why aren't 17-year-old men standing on the corner watching all the girls go by? If they were normal, healthy beings, they would be doing that. Because what we call normal healthy is where our particular heads are at. Freud is not describing what man is. He's describing what man was in Vienna in 1890. And it happens to be in New York City in 1960, partly through his description. In India, they say Freud suffered from the disease of the heart called passion. We have read so much poetry about passions that we really believe it. I mean, it's gotten so that if you don't lust sufficiently, you go to an analyst. You imagine that? Well, you can imagine that. I mean, if I said that to an Indian audience, they go, ooh. Sorry, wrong audience. I'll try it the other way. I mean, there are 17-year-old people who have never lusted after anybody. Can you imagine that? Pathology. Desire creates the universe. Feed a hungry... Feed a rooster, all these movies we used to show in Psych 1, you feed a rooster enough testosterone and it starts to make it with blocks of wood. Everything becomes a sexual object to it. You get a rat uptight enough and everybody becomes its enemy. I used to work in the field of achievement motivation. I used to set up projective tests to measure the need to achieve. And then they found out an interesting thing. They found out that the relation, you use a fantasy test, which you'd score, and you'd get a score for need achievement, and you'd score it to measure how much a person was motivated to achieve. Then you found out you could work it the other way around. And instead of using it as a thermometer, if you could get people to fantasy achieving, they would go out and achieve. So you started in India, they were starting to train people to have fantasies about achievement. Train them to desire. Train a person to have a social desire so that he will look at another person in a competitive way. Because if I look at you in a competitive way, I'll work harder to beat you. Now we have come through a system that we are totally reinforced for by saying, look at all of the technological advantages. Look at all we have because of the model of the universe we have developed, which is based on competition. It's called free enterprise. I once tried to put into the junior high schools in Lexington, Mass, a program, a physical education program, which really was based on my own training in karate. I didn't call it karate because the parents would never have bought that. We call it Eastern physical exercise. And the program involved non-competition. It involved focusing. It involved bringing the mind down to one-pointedness. Because if you're going to break boards, you've got to be able to focus your attention. Complete control of the mind. Completely non-competitive. You realize how alien that is to the whole culture of the school system? Everything is based on interpersonal competition. Because we assume that's what makes man do what he does. And if you didn't do that, as Freud suggests, if you didn't keep the lid on through these techniques, all hell would break loose. That's the illusion. That's the illusion about who we are. That's part of the thing Shakespeare wrote. Shakespeare wrote Freud. And Freud wrote us. Non-lying. Non-lying. Desire creates the universe. Desire creates the universe. Desire is the trap. Non-lying. You only have to lie if you're trying to, if you desire something. If I want to impress you, I might lie to you. A person who doesn't live in and gain, one to me is fame and shame. One to me is pleasure and pain. Can you imagine what it must be like to be that kind of a being? That's Om Mani Padme Hung, Om Mani Padme Hung. Because in that place, in Om Mani Padme Hung, no fame, no shame, no loss, no gain, no pleasure, no pain. You just are. It's isness. It's pure isness. Pure isness can also be called pure awareness, pure consciousness, pure love, pure energy. Many evenings we've gone through that equation. Let's say I decide I'm just going to try to go through a purification situation right here in New York City, and I'm married and I have a family and I have a job. Now, what do I do? I mean, let's say I'm going to cut out all the nonsense. What am I going to do? I don't want to talk theory anymore. I want to do something. Because I'm a Westerner, we do things. If I just say to you, be, oh, come on, that's very nice, but what do I do? What do I do to be? What do I do to be? First of all, you keep in mind at all times, desire is a trap, desirelessness is moksha, desire is the creator, desire is the destroyer, desire is the universe. So that means that as you live in your own Hamlet or Othello or whatever, or Midsummer Night's Dream, you just watch your desire create it all. Those of you that have taken psychedelics have been in the situation where you've looked into somebody's face and you felt a certain way about them. And then you suddenly, something happened and you felt a slightly different way about them, and suddenly their face changed. You call it an external hallucination. Well, this is all an external hallucination. Every bit of it. I mean, you don't know who's out here at all, because all you're seeing is what your desires are allowing you to see. And I said to my teacher, who will I lecture to if they want me to lecture? He says, you only ever talk to yourself. You only talk to your own desires. You are my desire. Now, that's a very abstruse one. Yeah, what do you mean I'm your desire? I am me. I am your desire. Who am I? Who am I? Am I? Boy, he's a suave hustler. Oh, he's a real holy man. He's so beautiful. Oh, he's got a big ego. He's a bald guy. He's kind of an intellectual. I can give you everything in your heads about who I am. Every one of them. And they're all true and they're all false. They're all lies and they're all true. Your desires are creating your universe. You can see, I can sit here and watch somebody come in here and there's nothing I can say. I've had this interesting phenomenon. I've been sitting here now for 3 weeks, right? Almost every night, there's always somebody here who comes in with their head fixed. They're like a block of concrete. And it reminds me of the parable of the black sheep, the shepherd and the black sheep. Somehow, when I see that block of concrete, I get completely fixated on it. All the rest, I look around, and there's all this liquid here and nowness, you see, and instead of just bathing in the sea of liquidity and just getting high out of my head on everybody, this contact high and all this love, I pick on this block of concrete, and I cajole and I seduce and I intellectually analyze and I look for the light back in there. The block of concrete sits there like a block of concrete. And I realize finally there's nothing I can say. I don't know, he's here because of what? Because he's trying to be intellectually open-minded? His wife brought him, maybe. There's a reason. There's a reason. But the reason is keeping him right, like, I'll come, but I won't enjoy it. I won't listen. Desire creates your universe. Desire creates your... It's the same thing with... My teacher said, if you walk on leather, the whole world is covered with leather. That's pretty far out. If you think on God, he said, the whole world is God.